Chapter 18. In which it appears that a man may possess a diamond, and yet be very hard-pressed for a dinner on that fatal Saturday evening, in a hackney coach, fetched from the Foundling, was I taken from my comfortable house and my dear little wife, whom Mr. Smithers was left, to console as he might. He said that I was compelled to take a journey upon business connected with the office. And my poor Mary made up a little portmanteau of clothes, and tied a comforter round my neck, and bade my companion, particularly to keep the coach windows shut, which injunction the grinning wretch promised to obey. Our journey was not long. It was only a shilling fare to Cursitor Street, Chancery Lane, and there I was set down. The house before which the coach stopped seemed to be only one of half a dozen in that street which were used for the same purpose. No man, be he ever so rich, can pass by those dismal houses, I think, without a shudder. The front windows are barred, and on the dingy pillar of the door was a shining brass plate, setting forth that Minadab, officer to the Sheriff of Middlesex, lived there. A little red-haired Israelite opened the first door as our coach drove up, and received me and my baggage. As soon as we entered the door, he barred it, and I found myself in the face of another huge door, which was strongly locked, and, at last, passing through that, we entered the lobby of the house. There is no need to describe it. It is very like 10,000 other houses in our dark city of London. There was a dirty passage and a dirty stair, and from the passage two dirty doors led into two filthy rooms, which had strong bars at the windows, and yet with an air of horrible finery that makes me uncomfortable to think of even yet. On the walls hung all sorts of trumpery pictures in tawdry frames, how different from those capital performances of my cousin Michelangelo. Semicolon on the mantelpiece huge French clocks, vases, and candlesticks. On the sideboards, enormous trays of Birmingham plated ware. For Mr. Aminadab not only arrested those who could not pay money, but lent it to those who could, and had already, in the way of trade, sold and bought these articles many times over. I agreed to take the back parlor for the night, and while a Hebrew damsel was arranging a little dusky sofa bedstead, woe betide him who has to sleep on it. I was invited into the front parlor, where Mr. Aminadab, bidding me take heart, told me I should have a dinner for nothing with a party who had just arrived. I did not want for dinner, but I was glad, not to be alone, not alone, even till Gus came, for whom I dispatched a messenger to his lodgings hard by. I found there, in the front parlor, at 8 o'clock in the evening, four gentlemen, just about to sit down to dinner. Surprising! There was Mr. B., a gentleman of fashion, who had only within half an hour arrived in a postchaise with his companion, Mr. Locke, an officer of Horsham Gaol. Mr. B. was arrested in this wise. He was a careless, good-humored gentleman, and had endorsed bills to a large amount for a friend, who, a man of high family and unquestionable honor, had pledged the latter, along with a number of the most solemn oaths, for the payment of the bills in question. Having endorsed the notes, young Mr. B., with a proper thoughtlessness, forgot all about them, and so, by some chance, did the friend whom he obliged. For, instead of being in London with the money for the payment of his obligations, this latter gentleman was traveling abroad, and never hinted one word to Mr. B. that the notes would fall upon him. The young gentleman was at Brighton lying sick of a fever, was taken from his bed by a bailiff, and carried, on a rainy day, to Horsham Gaol, had a relapse of his complaint, and when sufficiently recovered, was brought up to London to the house of Mr. Aminadab, where I found him a pale, thin, good-humored, lost young man. He was lying on a sofa, and had given orders for the dinner to which I was invited. The lad's face gave one pain to look at. It was impossible not to see that his hours were numbered. Now Mr. B. has not anything to do with my humble story, but I can't help mentioning him, as I saw him. He sent for his lawyer and his doctor, The former settled speedily his accounts with the bailiff, and the latter arranged all his earthly accounts. For after he went from the sponging house he never recovered from the shock of the arrest, and in a few weeks he died. And though this circumstance took place many years ago, I can't forget it to my dying day, and often see the author of Mr. B.'s death, a prosperous gentleman, riding a fine horse in the park, lounging at the window of a club, with many friends, no doubt, and a good reputation. I wonder whether the man sleeps easily, and eats with a good appetite? I wonder whether he has paid Mr. B.'s heirs the sum which that gentleman paid, and died for? If Mr. B.'s history has nothing to do with mine, and is only inserted here for the sake of a moral, what business have I to mention particulars of the dinner to which I was treated by that gentleman, in the sponging house in Cursitor Street? Why, for the moral too, and therefore the public must be told, of what really and truly that dinner consisted. There were 5 guests, and 3 silver tureens of soup, viz. Comma mock turtle soup, oxtail soup, and giblet soup. Next came a great piece of salmon, likewise on a silver dish, a roast goose, a roast saddle of mutton, roast game, and all sorts of adjuncts. In this way, can a gentleman live in a sponging house, if he be inclined? And over this repast which, in truth, I could not touch, for, let alone having dined, my heart was full of care. Over this meal my friend Gus Hoskins found me, when he received the letter that I had dispatched to him. Gus, who had never been in a prison before, and whose heart failed him as the red-headed young Moses opened and shut for him the numerous iron outer doors, was struck dumb to see me behind a bottle of claret, in a room blazing with gilt lamps. The curtains were down too, and you could not see the bars at the windows. And Mr. B, Mr. Locke the Brighton officer, Mr. Aminadab, and another rich gentleman of his trade and religious persuasion, were chirping as merrily, and looked as respectably, as any nobleman in the land. "Have him in," said Mr. B, "if he's a friend of Mr. Titmarsh's. For, cuss me, I like to see a rogue. And run me through, Titmarsh, but I think you are one of the best in London. You beat Bro. You do, by Jove. For he looks like a rogue anybody would swear to him. But you, by Jove, you look the very picture of honesty." "A deep file," said Aminadab, winking, and pointing me out to his friend Mr. Jehoshaphat. "A good one," says Jehoshaphat. "And for £300,000, says Aminadab. Ruff's right-hand man, and only 23. "Mr. Titmarsh, sir, Eriath, sir," says Mr. Locke, in an ecstasy of admiration. "Our very good earth, sir, and better luck to you next time." "Pooh, pooh. He's all right," says Aminadab. "Let him alone." "And for what?" shouted I, quite amazed. "Hi, sir, you arrested me for 90L. "Yes, but you are in for £500,000, you know you are. Them debts I don't count them paltry tradesmen's accounts. I mean bro's business. It's an ugly one, but you'll get through it. We all know you, and I lay my life that when you come through the court, Mrs. Titmarsh has got a handsome thing laid by." "Mrs. Titmarsh has a small property," says one. "Hat then?" The three gentlemen burst into a loud laugh, said I was a Chapeony Cove, and made other remarks which I could not understand then, but the meaning of which I have since comprehended, for they took me to be a great rascal, I am sorry to say, and supposed that I had robbed the one W.D. Association, and, in order to make my money secure, settled it on my wife. It was in the midst of this conversation that, as I said, Gus came in, and whew! When he saw what was going on, he gave such a whistle. "Herr von Joel, by Jove!" says Aminadab. At which all laughed. "Sit down," says Mr. B, "sit down, and wet your whistle, my piper. I say, egad, you're the piper that played before Moses. Had you there, Dab? Dab, get a fresh bottle of Burgundy for Mr. Hoskins. And before he knew where he was, there was Gus for the first time in his life drinking close Vougeot. Gus said he had never tasted Burgundy before, at which the bailiff sneered, and told him the name of the wine. Old Clo. What? Says Gus, and we laughed. But the Hebrew gents did not this time. Come, come, sir, says Mr. Aminadab's friend. We're all gentlemen here, and gentlemen never make ish reflexinch upon other gentlemen's pursuishinch. After this feast was concluded, Gus and I retired to my room to consult about my affairs. With regard to the responsibility incurred as a shareholder in the West Didlisex, I was not uneasy, for though the matter might cause me a little trouble at first, I knew I was not a shareholder, that the shares were scrip shares, making the dividend payable to the bearer, and my aunt had called back her shares, and consequently I was free. But it was very unpleasant to me to consider that I was in debt nearly £100 to tradesmen, chiefly of Mrs. Haggarty's recommendation, and as he had promised to be answerable for their bills, I determined to send her a letter reminding her of her promise, and begging her at the same time to relieve me from Mr. Von Stiltz's debt, for which I was arrested, and which was incurred not certainly at her desire, but at Mr. Bro's, and would never have been incurred by me, but at the absolute demand of that gentleman. I wrote to her, therefore, begging her to pay all these debts, and promised myself on Monday morning again to be with my dear wife. Gus carried off the letter, and promised to deliver it in Bernard Street after church time, taking care that Mary should know nothing at all of the painful situation in which I was placed. It was near midnight when we parted, and I tried to sleep as well as I could in the dirty little sofa bedstead of Mr. Aminadab's back parlor. That morning was fine and sunshiny, and I heard all the bells ringing cheerfully for church, and longed to be walking to the Foundling with my wife. But there were the three iron doors between me and liberty, and I had nothing for it but to read my prayers in my own room, and walk up and down afterwards in the court at the back of the house. Would you believe it? This very court was like a cage. Great iron bars covered it in from one end to another, and here it was that Mr. Aminadab's gal birds took the air. They had seen me reading out of the prayer book at the back parlor window, and all burst into a yell of laughter when I came to walk in the cage. One of them shouted out, "Men!" when I appeared. Another called me a muff, which means, in the slang language, a very silly fellow. A third wondered that I took to my prayer book yet. "When do you mean, sir?" says I to the fellow, a rough man, a horse dealer. "Why, when you are going to be hanged, you young hypocrite," says the man. "But that is always the way with bros people," continued he. "Had four greys once for him a great bargain, but he would not go to look at them at Tattersall's, nor speak a word of business about them, because it was a Sunday. Because there are hypocrites, sir," says I, "religion is not to be considered a bad thing, and if Mr. Bro would not deal with you on a Sunday, he certainly did his duty." The men only laughed the more at this rebuke, and evidently considered me a great criminal. I was glad to be released from their society by the appearance of Gus and Mr. Smithers. Both wore very long faces. They were ushered into my room, and, without any orders of mine, a bottle of wine and biscuits were brought in by Mr. Aminadab, which I really thought was very kind of him. "Drink a glass of wine, Mr. Titmarsh," says Smithers, "and read this letter. A pretty note was that which you sent to your aunt this morning, and here you have an answer to it." I drank the wine, and trembled rather as I read as follows. "Sir, if, because you knew I had designed to leave you my property, you wished to murder me, and so step into it, you are disappointed. Your villainy and ingratitude would have murdered me, had I not, by heaven's grace, been enabled to look for consolation elsewhere. For nearly a year I have been a martyr to you. I gave up everything, my happy home in the country, where all respected the name of Haggarty, my valuable furniture and wines, my plate, glass, and crockery, I brought all to make your home happy and respectable. I put up with the airs and impertinences of Mrs. Titmarsh. I loaded her and you with presents and benefits. I sacrificed myself. I gave up the best society in the land, to which I have been accustomed, in order to be a guardian and companion to you, and prevent, if possible, that waste and extravagance which I prophesied would be your ruin. Such waste and extravagance never, never, never did I see. Pewter wasted as if it had been dirt, coals flung away, candles burned at both ends, tea and meat the same. The butcher's bill in this house was enough to support 6 families. And now you have the audacity, being placed in prison justly for your crimes, for cheating me of 3,000 L, for robbing your mother of an insignificant sum, which to her, poor thing, was everything, though she will not feel her loss as I do, being all her life next door to a beggar, for incurring debts which you cannot pay, wherein you knew that your miserable income was quite unable to support your extravagance. You come upon me to pay your debts. No, sir, it is quite enough that your mother should go on the parish, and that your wife should sweep the streets, to which you have indeed brought them. I, at least, though cheated by you of a large sum, and obliged to pass my days in comparative ruin, can retire, and have some of the comforts to which my rank entitles me. The furniture in this house is mine, and as I presume you intend, dear lady, to sleep in the streets, I give you warning that I shall remove it all tomorrow. Mr. Smithers will tell you that I had intended to leave you my entire fortune. I have this morning, in his presence, solemnly tore up my will, and hereby renounce all connection with you and your beggarly family. Susan Haggarty. P.S.S. I took a viper into my bosom, and it stung me. I confess that, on the first reading of this letter, I was in such a fury that I forgot almost the painful situation in which it plunged me, and the ruin hanging over me. What a fool you were, Titmarsh, to write that letter, said Mr. Smithers. You have cut your own throat, sir, lost a fine property, written yourself out of 500 a year. Mrs. Haggarty, my client, brought the will, as she says, downstairs, and flung it into the fire before our faces. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.